right, we're going to go ahead and get started with our study tonight. Thank you all so much for being here. If you're watching online, thank you for joining us. Let's go ahead and begin with a prayer. Jordan, would you say a prayer for us?
Would you bow with me? Our Lord and God, we come before you to give you thanks. We've been blessed with another beautiful day, and once again, Lord, you've blessed us with the opportunity to gather together as your children and to study your word. We pray tonight as we look at the example of David and of Abigail that we would learn to have patience in our lives, we would learn to act with wisdom and prudence. We pray that we would take the lessons that we learned tonight that you teach us through your word and to make us better people and to make us better Christians, make us more like your son. In the name of your son, Jesus, we pray. Amen.
Amen. So tonight's obviously a little bit different. So Jordan and I are just kind of going to work through this chapter in 1 Samuel chapter 25, talk about Abigail. I told Jordan my main struggle, as you all well know, when teaching a class or preaching a sermon is trying to fill the allotted time. And so I talked to Jordan and he said he has the opposite problem. He never has enough time to say what he wants to say. So I thought, well, that would make for a pretty good team then. So I know I'm excited about this, and I know Jordan is very excited to talk about this chapter, 1 Samuel chapter 25. I'll begin with this, though. I think a lot about great character traits that people have, whether that's kindness or patience or love. You know, what are great character traits? I think about that often. I think one of the greatest character traits, or just traits that someone can have, is the ability to focus and make the right decision in the midst of chaos. I think that's a fascinating characteristic because it seems to be a characteristic that I cannot seem to grasp. And I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. Jordan, how are you with that? Do you feel like you're pretty good in the midst of chaos?
Yeah, my problem has usually never been like acting in the moment. My problem is always planning in the future. I'm a big procrastinator, but when it comes down to the wire, I can usually get things done if I'm not just totally confused.
Yeah,
which is more often than not where I find myself.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that and thinking, you know, isn't that trait? That's one of the reasons why we love Patrick Mahomes, right? I mean, it's fun to watch a quarterback throw boring passes for touchdowns, but when do we really like Patrick Mahomes? It's when he's doing something crazy. It's when people are chasing him all over the football field and he throws from his back leg 50 yards for a touchdown and all of that chaos. That's when we're like, okay, this guy's great. This is when we really like Patrick Mahomes. Or think about your favorite heroes in your favorite books or your favorite movies. Chances are that they probably have that trait. They're probably really good at making the right decision, being able to focus in the midst of chaos. And most likely, your favorite hero in whatever book or movie, or maybe even life that you can think of, someone you go to, you probably go to them because, you know, this person tends to make good decisions when things are really tough, when things are crazy. And even the Bible characters that we've studied about so far, we've seen that trait over and over again with Deborah, with Caleb, with Rahab. The reality is that heroes have that trait. Heroes are really good at that, being able to focus and make the right decisions. Because if heroes always made the wrong decision in chaos, they probably weren't heroes anyway. Heroes somehow seem to get the job done. So the story about me and chaos. This past weekend, I don't know if it maybe Sunday night, Bailey and I were just sitting on the couch. It was probably about 8:30. We were just watching TV. And then all of a sudden, we hear tires screeching outside, and we hear a crash. And so she jumps from one couch to the other couch to look out the window, and I'm circling around the couch to look out the front door. By the time I get to the front door, she's yelling at me, get the license plate numbers, get the license plate numbers. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? Like, I have no idea. Why would I need their license plate numbers? But as I open the door, I then see the car back away from our neighbor's fence that it had hit, and they're driving up the road. So they hit the fence, and they're just taking off, even though they did damage to the fence. They didn't want to actually, you know, stand, you know, be held accountable for that. And as they're driving away, about half a mile away, that's when I realize, oh, that's why we need the plates. Because Bailey was really good in chaos. She was already four steps ahead. She wanted to catch the person who hit the fence, and because she needed to do that, she needed to make sure she let the police know, and the police would need the license plate number, so that's where we would come in. We would need to have the license plate number. So the question is, what was going on in my head? Well, as I was walking towards the door, I actually like ripped a hole in my socks, and I was really annoyed by that as I was opening the door. She's trying to catch a criminal. I'm trying to fix my sock. So, all of that to say, she has that trait, and I'm still trying to find it. I'm still trying to get it. Abigail also has that trait. Undoubtedly, as we read this story, I hope you see that. In the midst of chaos, when her life was on the line, when the lives of her family, her friends, everyone that was involved with her family and in her household, their lives were on the line. And she made a very quick decision, a quick action, and it saved her life. It saved the lives of many others, and it saved the future king of Israel from sin. So let's go ahead and jump into our story. Jordan, could you read 1 Samuel 25, verses 1 through 3?
Absolutely. Then Samuel died, and the Israelites gathered together and lamented for him, and buried him in his home at Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Now there was a man in Moen whose business was in Carmel. And the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 3,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. She was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his doings. He was of the house of Caleb.
Jake, could you help me out with the slides? Okay, so one of the first characters we see is Nabal, or Nabal, however you want to pronounce that. Think of this guy as the kind of guy that Nabal's world revolved around Nabal. Everything he did, he went out and did everything for his own self-interest. Whatever business ventures he went in, he was in it for himself. Whenever he talked to someone, he was in it for himself. This is not the kind of person you want to be around, and especially not the kind of wealthy person you want to be around. I'm sure that you've known wealthy people throughout your life. I have, and there's been some wealthy people that I know that are the most generous, most giving, loving people, and those people are so fun to be with. They're so great because you know that their heart is kind, their heart is pure. I've also seen people who fall more into this category, who have a lot of money and who want you to know that they have a lot of money, and they don't really seem to care about you or about your life or about your needs that much. The Bible tells us he was rich, he was harsh, and he was badly behaved. And then we learn about David. Where's David at in this point in his life? I would probably imagine that right now David is exhausted because he's on the run from a crazy king who wants to kill him. He no longer has a position in Saul's army. He has no wife. He has no priest. He just left Jonathan, his best friend, who we talked about on Sunday. I mean, what do you think would be going through David's mind at this point? He's got to be just exhausted, right?
Well, he's spent a lot of time down, you know, in the previous chapters here in the south of Israel. And now he's made his way all the way up to Carmel, which is the exact opposite side. He's just come all this way after saving Saul's life, because the chapter before, David finds Saul in a cave and he saves his life. And they have a truce, and, you know, the truce lasts all of, you know, two pages here. You know, so I know he's very rightfully exhausted. He's very rightfully afraid for his own life because he's been all over the nation of Israel running with, and we find out later, 600 men. You know, that's a heavy burden to be walking around with.
Yeah. Could you turn to Psalm chapter 59, verses 1 through 7? This is most likely a psalm that David wrote at some point when he was on the run from Saul. But this gives you kind of a good idea of how David was feeling, what was going through his mind. Jordan?
To the chief musician, set to "Do Not Destroy," a Mitchum of David, when Saul and sent his men, and they watched in his house in order to kill him. Deliver me from my enemies, O God. Defend me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from the workers of iniquity, and save me from the bloodthirsty men. For look, they lie in wait for my life. The mighty gather against me, not for my transgressions nor my sin, O Lord. They run and prepare themselves through no fault of mine. Awake to help me, and behold, you therefore, O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, awake and punish all the nations. Do not be merciful to any wicked transgressors. At the evening they return, they growl like a dog, and they go all around the city. Indeed, they belch with their mouths. Swords are in their lips, for they say, who hears?
So, if you were having the feelings that David is having at this point, when you would be brought into some kind of chaos or would be asked to make a quick decision, how well do you think that decision would turn out? Probably not well at all. That's exactly what happens in this story. David makes an extremely poor decision that possibly under circumstances when he was maybe a little better rested, maybe better loved by the people he looked up to at one point in his life, I think he probably would have made a better decision than he did here in 1 Samuel 25. But here we have Nabal and David, two larger-than-life they're contrasting characters, but they're larger-than-life characters, and we're in the book of 1 Samuel. It's a book full of big characters. You've got Nabal, David, Saul, Jonathan, Goliath, Samuel, a lot of big names. But in the midst of all of these big names, there's a chapter that seems to be dedicated just to one person, telling the story of Abigail. There's a woman that comes to us, and that should hopefully come to our mind as a hero. So what about Abigail? The first thing I think about, the first question that comes to my mind is, how in the world did Abigail end up with this guy? Right? Is that, I'm seeing a lot of head shaking, yes. Everyone agrees, like, how did this happen? Well, maybe there's three possibilities. One, they got married, they were both ungodly, and Abigail became godly. Second option would be they got married, both were godly, and one stopped being godly. But maybe the third possibility is probably what happened, is that it was an arranged marriage, right? So if you were Abigail's father back in that time, you wanted to put your daughter with someone who had wealth, who had status. This was Nabal. So from a just society standpoint, this was a win-win for everyone. But for Abigail, the Bible describes her as intelligent and very beautiful. And then she gets stuck with someone who is harsh, badly behaved, and as we'll see in a little bit, I mean, even the man's servants are just afraid to even go talk to him. Not the kind of guy you want to be with at all. Someone once said Abigail is the greatest example of what a New Testament Christian looks like in the Old Testament. And the more I studied this and the more I thought about it, the more I realized I really agree with that. Because we'll see in this story how she seems to just offer to take blame on herself when it seems really hard to want to put any kind of blame on her. She really foreshadows Christ, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But she's full of integrity, very beautiful, and she puts both of those to use to prevent the future king from sin. So in the midst of chaos, this beautiful, smart woman appears and she saves the day. She's a smaller character, seemingly, in a book with more popular people. But if you remember about Jesus' ministry, what was his ministry all about? It was about highlighting the people that society looked at and disregarded. But here I think God is trying to help us see that Abigail is the hero. She is a major character in this book.
I think you bring up an excellent point. I think that's a theme you see of biblical main characters, heroes, protagonists in these stories all throughout the Bible. Just a book prior in Judges, we read the story of Gideon, who I think is an incredible highlight of that theme of someone you think is really small that becomes really big. He's talking to the Lord, and the Lord comes to him. He says, "Mighty man of valor." And Gideon says, "I'm not a mighty man of valor." In verse 6:15 of Judges, he says that he's from the smallest tribe. He's from the weakest clan of the smallest tribe. And in the clan that is the smallest in the tribe and in the nation, he's the least of his father's house. You know, he's this nobody. And I think that's a really big testament, because the whole story of Gideon highlights, yes, Gideon is nobody. His army is minuscule compared to the one that they go up against. And yet, Gideon's weakness is a magnifier for the strength of God that's told through that story. And I think, like you said, in Jesus' ministry, you know, by the time we have followed this theme through the Bible of weak people being made strong through God working through them, I think it's no surprise to people who are familiar with this theme when God chooses fishermen and tax collectors and political revolutionaries to be his apostle, the people who start his church and spread the gospel. I think it's a very powerful theme, and it's definitely here with Abigail. And I think that theme the purpose of that theme is twofold. And like I said, the first part is to magnify God's presence in the lives of these characters. And we'll see that later in this story, how glory is given to God through Abigail's actions. But also, I think it's a little bit for the readers. The readers are supposed to see themselves in these characters. They're not larger-than-life characters. They're real people, you know, and they have real problems, and they're small, kind of like me, the reader. And I can do that if only, you know, God is with me. I think that's another really powerful lesson we learned through a lot of these stories. And Abigail's an excellent example of that.
If we'll look and see examples of Nabal and David in this story, and there's some things that they do and say, and I think there's been times in my life when I tend to fall in line more with what they're doing and they're saying versus what Abigail is doing and saying. So before we read this next section and really get into the story, two things I want you to keep in mind as we read through this. First of all, Abigail foreshadows Jesus Christ. So just keep this in the back of your mind as we read through this. And the second part would be this: Abigail foreshadows the church. So keep an eye out for those comparisons. And if you see one, feel free just to comment and throw your hand up and say, "Oh, this is how I see Abigail foreshadowing either one." So, Jordan, could you read 1 Samuel 25:4-13?
When David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, "Go to Carmel and go to Nabal. Greet him in my name. And thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity, 'Peace be to you, peace be to your house, and peace be to all you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them, nor were there anything missing from all them, for them all, while we were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever comes to your hand to the servants of David and David your son.' So when David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all the words of David in the name of David and waited. Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, 'Who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away each one from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have for my men when I do not know where they come from? So David's young men turned on their heels and went back. And they came and told these words. Then David said to his men, every man gird on your sword. So every man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed by with the supplies. Is it 14?
Just through 13. So we talked about this question a lot as we read through this. Is Nabal in his right to say no? And I know that was a question that you asked me, and you said you wanted to talk about it, and I was like, that's hard for me to even ask because I don't know. I struggle with that question. So what did you think? Was Nabal in his right to say no? To say, sorry, David, this is stuff that I've worked for. I'm not just going to start giving handouts.
Yeah. That was one that kind of stuck out to me. Like, well, you know, David is asking this guy for food and stuff. And it seems like, I don't know if they had some sort of agreement, but they may not even have had, you know, a formal business agreement. So David comes to Nabal and he asks for this stuff for free, it seems, to Nabal. I mean, yeah, so I was curious to think what everyone here, what would your response be to David? Do you think Nabal is in his rights to say, yeah, no thanks? Would you do similarly?
He might have been technically correct, but it wasn't smart. It wasn't the right answer to give. And he should have been considering the whole situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, considering the fact, oh, you have an army? Okay, let me find some food for you.
Yeah. And he had an abundance. He was a rich man. Mm-hmm. Should have been willing to share it.
Absolutely.
That's your hand? Yeah.
I think he had the right to say no. If maybe his circumstances might have been a little bit different. You know, it's like our feast is already over. We weren't able to prepare much food. You know, but he is belligerent in his answer. Mm-hmm.
I think you bring up an excellent point. You know, maybe if things were different, but he is being very petty to David because it seems like he doesn't know who David is because he says, well, who is David, right? But then he says, who is David and who is the son of Jesse? So he knows David's dad's name. But then he goes on and it digs a little further when he says, well, there's a lot of servants nowadays who are breaking away from their masters, which clearly says he knows he's on the run from Saul. And he's just digging it in. I think another interesting point that you brought up is it's a feast day. I don't know that David is really asking for that much because, you know, I always assumed it was, well, he's walking around with 600 men. He's got a lot of mouths to feed. But if you look at later in the story, what Abigail gives to David, it's not enough to keep 600 men going for more than a day. I think David was just going there to share in the abundance of the feast. You know, this is a feast day. Hey, we've been protecting your people for this whole time. You know, can you just give us some food so we can enjoy the feast with you? You know, out of your abundance, whatever comes to your hand. You know, and so it's just a major slap in the face. It's an honor thing. Maybe he was in his rights. That's a good point.
Yeah. Yep. Anyone else?
Could it be political? Like, could it be the fact that if he's a person of standing, maybe he's kind of buddy buddies with Saul on some level?
Yeah, it could be. I never thought about that, but it could be. Or it even could be like, you know, Nabal's more like, you know, okay, come back with a better offer. You know, like, give me a little bit of something in return. Maybe some kind of political standing could be involved with that, too. I don't know. But it could be that he knew Saul. Yeah.
David had supplies. He left 200 men back to watch him. So he just wanted, maybe he was testing Nabal, but maybe he really had a need for certain things. But he had some stuff.
That's true.
This is a simplistic answer, but I've found when Lauren calls me worthless and stupid, it's not because I've done something right. So,
Lauren, would you also like to make a comment?
Yeah, it does seem like at the time, you know, like, well, you shared with me a sermon to listen to in preparation for this, and the guy giving the sermon said, isn't that kind of an American attitude that Nabal has, the shall I take my bread and my water and my meat, and I have killed for my shearers? Like, that seems like a very up by your bootstraps kind of way to go about the situation. I've heard that similar sentiment occasionally as we walk down the street and you see maybe a homeless person. Just to kind of bring it home, that kind of hit me right between the eyes when he said that. Oh,
yeah. I was just thinking in respect to, like, David's been a shepherd from, you know, when he was younger and whatnot. So he's thinking like a shepherd. Let's protect these men who are all watching their sheep that are Nabal's sheep shears while they're shearing the sheep, so to keep the wild animals away, do all that. So in a way, David was sort of working for Nabal, and it was just asking, hey, could you share in this feast day because we did this little bit of extra for you to keep your sheep shearers safe. That's how I always thought of it.
Great point.
I didn't think about that. He would be thinking like a shepherd, because that's something he would have thought was nice back when he was doing it, having someone walking around with swords. All he had was a sling.
Yep. So before we move on to the next point, just I thought a quick application point that I really learned from David is the need to be self-aware of our weakness. So obviously in this moment, if David would have just been able to take a step back and realize, okay, I'm probably really exhausted, I'm really tired, I probably need a little bit more food than maybe I've had recently. Before I go making any rash decisions, or before I make a decision in anger, I really need to take a step back and think about it a little more. And that's something I just thought would be, we could pull out of this from David. Because you think about when Jesus was tempted, when Satan went and tempted Jesus, when did he do that? Well, he did it when he was in the wilderness and he was hungry and he knew Jesus was weak. And obviously here, I have no doubt that Satan was looking at David thinking the same exact thing. Oh, here you are in the wilderness. You're weak. You're exhausted. You're probably not in your best mind. So this is when I'm really going to tempt you. Okay, let's move on. Could you read 14 through 22?
Now one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as they accompanied us when we were in the fields. They were a wall to us both day and night. All the time they were with us while we were keeping the sheep. Now, therefore, know and consider what you will do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his household, for he is such a scoundrel, and one cannot speak to him. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread and 2 skins of fine wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. And she said to her servants, go on before me. See, I am coming after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. So it was, as she rode on the donkey, that she went down under cover of the hill, and there were David and his men coming toward her, and she met them. Now David said, surely in vain I have protected all this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing has been missed, all that belongs to him. And he has repaid me evil with good. May God do so and more also to the enemies of David, if I leave one male of all who belong to him by morning light.
You know, it must have been really tempting for Abigail when she hears that, oh, here comes David, the future king, with an army of 400 men to kill my lazy, unloving husband. Maybe something like, man, doesn't God just work in mysterious ways? I haven't visited my parents in a while. I think I'm going to take the afternoon and go see them. To me, it seems that would have been a temptation for me if I was in her shoes. But What does the scripture say? Immediately. She made haste and immediately. It doesn't even seem like that kind of an idea about, you know, Nabal's got it coming to him. That doesn't even seem to cross her mind for a second. That's incredible. That's what I was talking about earlier, that trait of being able to make the right decision in chaos. That's this decision right here, to go, okay, you know what? I'm going to cover for Nabal. It seems to me that this probably wasn't the first time she's had to do something like this. Because if Nabal is harsh, badly behaved, and how quickly she made this decision, to me that says she's been in this situation a few times before when she's had to cover for her husband. Casey?
It looks like she's the only one that's sound thinking. I mean, David seems to have a pretty harsh answer to some servants being slighted and, you know, bringing a whole army in ready to kill everybody. And, of course, Nabal's already a worthless person. But she only seems to be the one that's cool-headed in the whole situation.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. Yes?
When you asked earlier if Nabal was, if he had the right to refuse, I started trying to think of other examples that we could compare this with. And strangely enough, I thought of Nabal and Ahab, because Ahab wanted Nabal's vineyard and asked for it and actually offered him money, so that was arguably a better offer than David. And in both cases, they were turned down, and in both cases, the result was they wanted to go kill the person. So actually, we don't compare Ahab and David very often in character, but they had the same reaction to being slighted or turned down. And in both cases, a woman actually ended up driving the outcome of the situation. On the one hand, Jezebel told Ahab, stop sulking, just go kill him and take it. And here you have Abigail being the de-escalator going and preventing problems.
Right. That's a great point. And you see, here you see the contrast of the only one in the story that seems to have the right mind. David is thinking, okay, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, you'll get yours. And then on the other flip side, Abigail is saying, you know, you show me evil, I'm going to show you a gentle answer. I'm going to show you kindness. I'm going to show you beauty and integrity. And so that's where we see a foreshadowing of Jesus, right? That's, to me, that's clear. Jesus on every page, like we talked about a couple of years ago. This is Jesus in 1 Samuel 25.
And one thing I was thinking as I was reading through this is, like, in this story, Abigail's really not in danger. And I suspect she may know that because there are many other Bible passages where if a place is attacked, all the men are killed, but the women and the children are left alive, and sometimes the livestock, you know. And so Abigail may know she's not in any danger from David, and yet for her worthless husband, she steps in the way of that danger, which is kind of crazy to me. And it's also crazy because, like you said, if she randomly just decided to go visit her parents that day, this story would not have been like, oh, and then there was Abigail, Nabal's wife. You know, what a coward she was. I don't think she would be even mentioned. I don't think anyone would have faulted her for stepping out of this situation. But it was the difference between that and doing the right thing. And I think maybe that's even a harder choice because no one would have expected this of her. And she did the above and beyond the right thing, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So let's go ahead and skip to our next section here. Could you just read verse 23 and then verse 28.
May the Lord repay every man for... I'm over here. 26.
Sorry. Verse 23 and 28.
Now when Abigail saw David, she dismounted quickly from her donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed on the ground. And in verse 28, please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because the Lord fights the battles of the Lord, and the evil is not found in you throughout your days.
Okay. The first thing out of Abigail's mouth, really hard for me to kind of stomach and to read and try to understand. Abigail, what are you talking about? What do you mean, on me alone be the guilt? And then in verse 28, please forgive the trespass of your servant. What, Abigail, you haven't done anything wrong. What are you talking about? So I'll ask you, should Abigail have taken the blame for this? What do you think? What is she doing here?
She may have thought it may have been the only way that would have calmed him down. That, you know, I can't even talk. And also, he may not have known that she knew anything about it. You know, so maybe from her perspective, she felt like it was the only choice she could have made. But I will say, as a sidebar to that, even if I just said here, like, peace, I don't think I, like, in any sense of the word, could have just taken the blame for it. Like, at my best, I would have been just here. This is from us. You know what I mean? I just, yeah. I don't, like, it's so outside of our realm of comprehension, I think, to, you know, imagine doing that. So I just have to be honest. That's just, it blows my mind. It really
Same.
Is.
Absolutely.
Yep. She knew she was the reasonable one. So that's where her responsibility came. She knew that he didn't have the right type of focus at all. Mm-hmm. She stepped up and became the partner with the good wife of Pete.
I think you see, certainly in her wisdom, you also see a trait that I think is very critical in resolving conflict, and that's to not put blame on someone else, but be prepared, even if it's not your fault, to accept the responsibility and the blame. Mm-hmm. Because it takes the other person away from, you know, focusing on who's at fault and puts them in a defensive mode. So it shows her wisdom. It's a great example of how to deal with others in a difficult situation.
Right. Because what Abigail does here is exactly what Jesus did, right? I mean, if we haven't been able to really see Jesus yet in this chapter, to me, this maybe stands out more than anything else. We're able to clearly see, Abigail, you haven't done anything wrong. And in the same way, Jesus obviously didn't do anything wrong, but yet he still took on our sin and paid the price for that. So just a couple things before we move on. One thing I see, keeping others from sin and reminding others that God is working is a beautiful thing. And that's what Abigail does here. She keeps David from sin, from entering his kingship without having any blood on his hand. And also reminding him, even referencing him killing Goliath. She references his sling. So reminding him again, hey, David, let's think clearly here. Think about how God is working in your life. Don't make this mistake. And the second thing would be, sometimes you may be the only one who seems to want to do the right thing, and God still sees that. So like we said, Abigail is the only one in this story that seemingly wants to do the right thing, has their head on straight. And whenever we're in that same situation, we need to remember God sees us doing that. We're not alone there. Okay. Let's go ahead and move on to our next section. Read 36 through 42, please.
Now Abigail went to Nabal, and there he was holding a feast in his house, and it was like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was very merry within him, and he was very drunk. Therefore she told him nothing, little or much, until the morning light. So it was in the morning, when the wine had gone from Nabal, and his wife had told him these things, that his heart died within him, and he became like a stone. Then it had happened after about 10 days, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. So when David heard the words that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord, who has pleaded on the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal, and he has kept his servant from evil. For the Lord has returned the wickedness of Nabal upon his own head." And David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David had come to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, "David sent us to ask you to become his wife." Then she arose, bowed on her face to the earth, and said, "Here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." So Abigail arose in haste and rode on a donkey, and attended by 5 other maidens, she followed the messengers of David and became his wife.
Okay, just a few things quickly before we end. So I think we see clearly in this story that Abigail is a foreshadowing of Christ. But then in another sense, we see that Abigail is a foreshadowing of the church, right? Because here is Abigail. She's married to someone who is unloving, harsh, badly behaved, and yet here she is. She is pure. In this story, she hasn't done anything wrong, but at the end of the day, she gets to marry the king. And isn't that kind of a foreshadowing of what we as the church will be able to do? We will be able to be with the king. Now, before we go, this is the major difference. Read verse 43.
Oh, I got it.
Sorry, I sprung that one on you.
Verse 43, and also David took Abinoam of Jezreel, and so both of them were married as his wives.
Yeah. Okay, so my first thought is, David, what are you doing, David? And then my second thought is, you know, here's Abigail. She's finally with the kind of man that she really thought she wanted to, or, you know, what we thought maybe she would have deserved. And then here goes this man, and he goes and marries two other women. How devastating that would have been to Abigail. But what I learned from that is God will never wander from us, even those we love might. So we, as the church, when we get to be with the king, we don't have to worry about him wandering or looking after someone else. We are his prized possession. So thank you so much for your comments tonight, and hope you've enjoyed class. I sure have enjoyed studying this, so thank you so much.